Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, and I am Lavonia Mallory.
And I'm your host, Guy Schaefer. Today we're going to be discussing Kwanzaa with the Kwanzaa Coalition. After that, we're going to be hearing about the Green Party's legislative agenda for 2019. Then we'll have Lavonia Mallory with part two of Reclaiming History with Dr. Kim's titled The Alt-Right's Co-opting of the Medieval Period. Then another segment entitled Health Watch with Dr. Sista as she's discussing, as he's discussing pulmonary embolism. Then we'll close off the show in conversation with Jada Juf talking about the organization Moms Rising. But let's start off the show with some rapid-fire headlines.
In breaking news, Detective James Olson will be facing criminal charges. For shooting Alizar Williams, will not be facing criminal charges for shooting Alizar Williams. The 19-year-old who was left paralyzed by a bullet Olson fired during a foot chase last summer. Albany County District Attorney David Soares announced today that a grand jury declined to file charges against the officer in connection with the August 20th shooting on Elk Street. Residents and advocates have been insistent that the surveillance video from the school shows Williams running away from Olson when he was shot.
British Prime Minister Theresa May launched a rescue mission for her ailing Brexit deal Friday after the European Union rebuffed her request to sweeten the divorce agreement so she can win over hostile lawmakers at home. EU leaders meeting in Brussels showed little appetite to resolve May's Brexit impasse for her, saying the UK Parliament must make up its mind. The choice was either back the Brexit agreement or send Britain tumbling out of the bloc in March without a deal and into unknown economic chaos.
Senator John Kyle is resigning from the seat he was appointed to less than 4 months ago following the death of John McCain. Governor Doug Ducey announced Friday, a development which gives Ducey a second opportunity to fill the position. Kyle, 76, had said he was only committed to serving through the end of the year, although Ducey said he had hoped to persuade him to serve through 2020. His resignation is effective December 31st and forces a pivotal decision by the state's Republican governor.
In back-to-back votes against Saudi Arabia, the Senate delivered an unusual rebuke of President Donald Trump's response to the death of journalist Gamal Khashoggi and signaled new skepticism from Capitol Hill towards a longtime Middle East ally. Although the resolutions are largely symbolic because it's unclear if they will be considered by the House, their passage Thursday showed senators seeking to assert oversight of Trump administration foreign policy and the relationship with Saudi Arabia. It also marked the collapse of the Trump administration's effort in the Senate to contain fallout from the gruesome killing. Then finally, Hawthorne Cedar Knolls, located in the town of Mount Pleasant, began experiencing unusually high rates of teenagers going missing from its campus. Many of the girls in the rehabilitation center had been placed to rescue from the sex trade. On Thursday, the breadth of a pipeline carrying young women out of Hawthorne and into prostitution became clearer. 19 people were charged in a sex trafficking ring that exploited young women and girls as young as 13-year-olds, federal prosecutors said. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
Today, we have two very special guests in the studio with us live, Capital Region Kwanzaa Representative Brother Aaron Sijawisha Carter of Ajima Journey, and Sister Janice, say your last name for me. I don't want to mess it up.
Mwapaga
of the African American Culture Center. So these guys are getting ready for Kwanzaa. We're right there, Guy. This is it. We're getting so close. For my listeners, listen, tell us a little bit about what exactly is Kwanzaa. I mean, is it Christmas or is it Kwanzaa?
It's Kwanzaa for sure. It's a Afrocentric holiday, black holiday. Kwanzaa meaning
The meaning behind the Kwanzaa celebration is family, community, and culture. It's a Swahili word taken from the first fruit celebration, Matunda Ya. I forgot the last name now.
La Kwanzaa,
mm-hmm. Which is the Swahili, and it's spelled with the Kwanza. And then the person who developed it, Milana Karanga, he put the added A for our experience here in America and the struggles that grew out of the 60s. Mm. And so from our roots of the African diaspora and the continent, and then our experience here in North America, come up with the Kwanzaa celebration. Mm.
Can you all talk about the history of Kwanzaa? How long has it been a holiday, and when did it start?
1966 in California from the US organization, again, Milana Karanga. And it has grown to over 50 or 60 million celebration. It's a celebration of it's an Afrocentric holiday, and from December 26th to January 1st.
So do you light candles during the Kwanzaa celebration? And if so, what do the candles mean?
Yes, there are seven candles, one for each of the 7 days mm-hmm. of Kwanzaa. And the first one is unity. And obviously that's going to be very critical for self-reliance and independence of a people. And you light the first candle, and then that is the black candle. And from that day on, all of the other candles, the following six, are lighted from the first candle, which is the black candle. And each day represents a different principle. Mm-hmm. And as I said, the first one is unity. And without going into all seven of them, and maybe Brother Sita Wisha will want to go into them in more detail, but the second one is self-determination. And those two, unity and self-determination, to me are rightfully so at the top. And each day, again, represents a principle for us to live by throughout the entire year. But it's the culmination of our work and efforts that we celebrate on the 26th. But all through the year, we're to try our best to embody all of these seven principles.
So there are seven principles to Kwanzaa. Give them to me again, the seven.
Okay. Unity, umoja in Swahili. Mm-hmm. Two, self-determination, mm-hmm. Kujichakalia. Third one is collective work responsibility, ujima. Fourth one is cooperative economics, ujamaa. The fifth one is purpose, nia. And the sixth one is the creativity, kuumba. Mm. And the seventh one is the faith, imani.
Those are awesome principles. Those are like so radical, like compared to like Christmas, which mm-hmm. I don't know what Christmas principles even are, but like
it's a celebration of it's a religious celebration. Right. And this is not a religious celebration.
No.
Is it a political celebration?
It's a cultural.
It's a cultural celebration.
Expression of a people. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And how many people are involved in the coalition? How many people are represented by this organization?
Well, for sure, seven. Because mm-hmm. there's seven different days in which we're going to celebrate it.
Okay.
First opening day will be at the New York State Museum on the 26th. The doors open up at 6 o'clock. People can come at 5, but 6 o'clock. And then and that's the who makes up the coalition are, Ujima, and mm-hmm. then there's the African American Culture Center, there's the Hamilton Hill Arts Center, there's Hero Team Hero in Troy.
Okay.
Of the Boys and
Boys,
Girls.
Boys and Girls Club. There's God in Action Ministry. There's Mount Olivet Baptist Church in Schenectady.
Okay.
And
So it seems LLC. Like a pretty diverse.
And the LOC. Ooh, I, man, that's my other organization. The LOC and EA2 School Academy.
So it seems like a pretty diverse group of people coming together mm-hmm. to celebrate this culture. It's a cultural celebration. Mm-hmm. And so what sort of activities will you be doing during the celebration at the museum? And where do you go next? Because you started at the museum, but I think you're going somewhere else after that.
Right. Well, the first day we will represent in many different forms those seven principles. So there will be Black-owned businesses to symbolize or to be the embodiment of self-determination and Ujamaa. Mm-hmm. And we'll also have artwork and perhaps art activities, I believe. Mm-hmm. There yes. will be the art activities.
And games for the children.
And games mm-hmm. and various games, in fact, and mm-hmm. African games will be played there. Now, the speaker who is coming this year is Professor Kaba Kamenei, and this is a very dynamic scholar, and he is just a prolific teacher on African history and culture. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, everybody is going to want to make sure they have a chance to come out for that. And the other thing is there will be music to represent the arts.
Okay.
And again, that's for our creativity day and principle. We have to make sure that's there. And we'll have workshops. Well, actually, the presenter, mm-hmm. there usually are workshops, and there will possibly be workshops at some of the on the other days of the week. And that is to represent the education component.
And this professor, you said he's a professor and an author? And
yes. He is a professor. He is an instructor at SUNY New Paltz, University at New Paltz.
Okay.
And he is very well traveled. He's world renowned. And you can pick up his videos on YouTube and on the internet. He does presentations constantly throughout the region and in New York State and all over the country as well as in other countries. And he is very well versed in Nile Valley civilization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So on some of the material that you brought in today, it says that he is a scholar in African American history, and somehow or another he's connected to Hidden Colors.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was one of the main stars featured in the series.
So what is Hidden Colors? For our listeners who don't know, what is Hidden Colors?
Oh, it's a walk through time of our existence of humanity's first civilization, the Black civilization. And it's what's so wonderful about it, and also it's very enlightening, but like it's something that should be known and taught easily because it represents the universe. And to be hidden, as the title has, Hidden Colors, is a hidden truth of who humanity is and who Black people is. And that would, I tell you, that would answer a lot of questions within the Black community. To know thyself is one of the most key thing that can be done when you live out your story versus somebody else's story.
So why is it important for African Americans to participate in Kwanzaa and, as you say, know themselves? Why is that why is that important?
Well, because of the celebration of who we are as a people, and that we are more understood as a connection to the existence of humanity, and that first in line is who we are. We're not last, but we're first. And put last, coming to be first, because we're learning more about ourselves. which is very crucial for the family, for unity, for the whole seven principles, you know, coming together, bonding together, defining ourselves, name ourselves, creating for ourselves, speaking for ourselves, and whatnot, working together, putting the sense of resources, self-reliance, and also making it resources come together.
So where will you go after you leave the museum? What are the next stops for the Kwanzaa celebration?
Okay, the first site after the museum will be at the African American Cultural Center. And that's actually not going to be the site, but that is the organization putting on the program. It will be located at the Albany Housing Authority, and that is located at 200 South Pearl Street in Albany, New York. And it's right down the street from the center.
So that's going to be December 27th.
Exactly.
And what time will that start?
That will start at 6 o'clock and go until 8:30.
And then where's the next stop?
Mount Olivet in Schenectady, and that's located at 1068 Park Avenue, Schenectady, New York. And that starts at 6 p.m.
Okay. And then the next?
Here in Troy.
Here in Troy.
Ujamaa, Team Hero, Boys and Girls Club. And that will start at 4 p.m.
And that rounds out the program?
No.
You got one more?
We got
a few more.
Okay.
This is the fifth day. It'll be Nia. It'll be the God in Action Ministry at 158 3rd Avenue in Albany, New York at 3 p.m. And then the sixth day, the Kumumba Creativity, will be at the Hamilton Hill Art Center, 409 Schenectady Street, starting at 6 p.m. And then the last day, Imani, which is a faith, will be Hamilton Hill is the host, but it will be at the City Mission in Schenectady at 512 Smith Street.
All right.
In Schenectady, New York. At the time, it will be 6 p.m.
So with the few 2 minutes we have left, can you tell my listeners how they can reach you if they have questions or there's any contact information available for our listeners to reach out to you guys?
Can't see the phone number.
Well, one of the phone numbers, the one that is on the Common A flyer, is 334. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that's area code 518, 334-5591.
All right. Mm-hmm. So is there any last information you want to share with our listeners about the event or about the purpose before we close?
First of all, it's no cost. Mm-hmm. Okay, and but there will be vendors there to sell various things and bear witness to the beauty of who we are as a people, and bring the family, because Kwanzaa is a celebration of family, community, and culture.
And I think my last words will be, again, this is just 1 week out of the year, but the thought to go away with is that this is a year-round philosophy and value system that we're all as Africans in the diaspora as well as on the continent to live by and to come together for.
So I know whenever I see Aaron on the street and we say hi, there's a way in which you acknowledge each other in Swahili. For my listeners, how would you acknowledge a person in a Swahili language?
Well, the general understanding since 1966 has been a Rambe, and when it's not the holiday, it's the many different answers to Habarigani, what's the news, and it's Njema, Asante, Habarigani back. But Kwanzaa, it's represented by the principal, so it's Habarigani, and then whatever day that day is, that's the response you give it. So if it's on the first day, it's Habarigani answer, Umoja.
Would be Umoja.
Umoja. Mm-hmm. Well, to Aaron and my sister. Mm-hmm. Say your last name again, my sister.
Mwapaga.
Mwapaga.
Mm-hmm.
So how should I greet you?
Habarigani.
Habarigani.
And I would respond, Umoja.
Habarigani.
Umoja.
Emoja. Mm-hmm. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
Asante sana.
All right. So listen, that was a great presentation from the Capital Region Kwanzaa Coalition representatives talking about the beginning of Kwanzaa, which will start on December 26th. Make sure you mark your calendars.
If you're just joining... Thank you guys so much for coming in. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOC 105.3 FM. Next up, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Dunley brings us updates from C.J. Chapman and Peter Lavinia of the New York State Green Party, who outlined their state legislative agenda for 2019. The agenda includes Green New Deal and climate action, single-payer health care, marijuana legalization, voting rights, and criminal justice reform.
So this week, the Green Party of New York State unveiled its legislative agenda for 2019 at the state level. C.J. Chapman and Peter Lavinia, state party co-chair, were two of the presenters. First, we talked to Peter. What were some of the key issues that was highlighted in terms of legislative priorities?
We have four main issues this session. The first one is serious action on climate change. We want a Green New Deal. Secondly, we'd like to see real single-payer health care, the New York Health Act, passed this session. Marijuana reform and legalization. We need to have criminal justice reform as well. And finally, we need electoral reform here in New York State, not just a full-time legislature, which we support, and ban on outside income, but also we need real ranked choice voting and proportional representation to make sure every vote counts and that we have more voices and choices in the New York State legislature.
CJ, you mentioned it during the press conference that you're, a new mother, and as such, you're concerned about health care both for your child and for yourself. So what are some of your personal reasons why you're supportive of a single-payer health care system?
Well, for me, I think that single-payer health care is, and access to health care in general, is an issue that affects so many people from so many different demographics, and it's something that all working people can get behind and really band together to try to pass. And in my personal experience, I myself am on Medicaid, my child is on Medicaid, but that's a very tenuous situation. I said at the press conference, and it's totally true, every time I get a letter from DSS, I think to myself, is this the letter that's going to say I don't have health care anymore? And my partner gets health care through his work, but he can't even go to the doctor with the copays that they're so high. And if he had to be in the hospital, there's no way we could pay our rent and also pay the deductible at the same time. And that's a person who works, he's in a union job, he works 40 to 60 hour weeks depending on the week, and he should be able to go to the doctor and get preventative care and get emergency care. And I shouldn't have to worry that my child isn't going to be able to receive care when he needs it. And in a country where insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies are profiting so much, and they are benefiting at the expense of regular working New Yorkers, and to me, healthcare is a human right, and I care about human rights. I got my start as an activist working on children's rights, and to me, that this is a children's rights issue and a family rights issue.
So why do you think single-payer health care would be an improvement? And, how is that particular proposal, looking in the state legislature at the moment?
I think single-payer health care would be an improvement because it would be fair, it would be universal, and we would get the insurance companies out of the picture. And as far as how that's looking in the legislature, the New York Health Act has passed in the Assembly for the past 4 years. It has had almost half of the state senators as co-sponsors. And now that both houses are controlled by the Democrats, theoretically that should mean that we should be able to pass it. That said, just because Democrats campaigned on supporting this doesn't mean that they're going to bring it to the floor or vote on it this session. And that's why we still really need to continue the work that we're doing to put pressure on them and hold them accountable.
So, Peter, you mentioned, you know, voting reform as one of the key issues for the Green Party. What are you hearing in terms of what the state legislature is considering? And, you know, do you have different proposals you would like to see advance?
What I've heard that the state legislature is considering, and granted this has just been out in the media, they haven't really talked about it concretely, but they're talking about extending days that you can vote, automatic voter registration. You know, I've heard, you know, potentially that we might see some form of public campaign financing. So there's a lot of stuff floating around out there that I think has been discussed as kind of baseline stuff that we need in New York State and across the country. But, you know, the Green Party is asking for the legislature to go further than that. You know, we'd like to see ranked choice voting. You know, Maine passed this.
I'm sorry, what is ranked choice voting?
So ranked choice voting, essentially you rank candidates based on your order of preference. And at a certain point, if the candidate that you choose doesn't receive enough votes, then your second choice votes start being counted. And what this means is that you get 50% of the vote for the winning candidate. So this just happened in Maine, where a candidate, two candidates didn't receive a majority in the first round. They each received about 46 or 47% of the vote. But then the second choice votes put the one of the candidates over the top.
I believe a Democrat.
I do believe a Democrat. And so what we'd like to see is this ranked choice voting instituted across New York State. I believe a little over 10 years ago, Senator Krueger had a bill that would have allowed this to happen. Now that the Democrats are in control of the Senate, we think that, you know, this should be one of the things that they enact pretty quickly. They're always complaining about, the Democrats are always complaining about the spoiler effect. This completely eliminates the so-called spoiler effect. And it would also mean that there'd be more voices and choices. You know, people wouldn't have to worry about, oh, am I voting for this candidate or that? And what might happen, right? And that's what we often encounter as Greens, right? And we'd also like to see proportional representation. You know, this is a bigger push, but it's the idea that, hey, parties should be seated, candidates should be seated based on the percentage that their party gets across the state. This could help end gerrymandering, right? One of the ways that you can do proportional representation is to have one big district, and so you don't have to worry about how you cut the lines. And it also usually means in places that have proportional representation that more women, minorities, working class people are represented as well. And we think that there'd be more parties in the New York State Legislature, like the Greens and Libertarians, Socialists, more voices and choices for New Yorkers. It seems like a no-brainer to us.
Now, one of the or two of the issues you talked about are related. One is the issue of marijuana legalization, which the governor now kind of says he, you know, supports. And then the related issue of criminal justice reform. You know, what are some of the key aspects of those issues that you're hoping the legislature will adopt?
It seems like the legislature is going to address marijuana legalization in 2019. We've seen a number of states around us do so already, or they're debating legalizing. And what we've seen is, you know, the Department of Health put out a report a couple of months ago saying that there would be tax benefits to this. You know, the Greens look at it like this. You know, we've been calling for marijuana legalization for decades, and we think that New York State needs to make sure that this is part of the 2019 agenda. We need to make sure that, that, you know, corporations don't dominate the marijuana market. People should be allowed to grow at home. We should make sure that there are non-GMO crops and that we're not having GMO seeds come in. And we need to make sure that there's criminal justice reform coupled with that marijuana legalization, because this is at the core of the so-called war on drugs is mass incarceration, right? We need to make sure that nonviolent drug offenders are released, that their records are expunged, and that they are given opportunities to either participate in what would now be a legal marijuana industry or restitution for what's happened to them. And the money that is made from marijuana legalization should be directed towards rebuilding communities, especially poor communities of color that have been devastated by the drug war. I mean, this is something we think that absolutely needs to happen when we talk about marijuana legalization. This shouldn't just be about large corporations getting wealthy on now legal marijuana.
So we've been talking with C.C. Chapman and Peter Lavigne. If people want more information about the Green Party, you know, where do they get that? And maybe, C.J., if you have a last, you know, any input you want to put.
You can find us on social media and on the web, you know, www.gpny.org, Green Party of New York on Facebook. We're on Twitter as well. So you can find us at all of those places.
And any last comments from CJ?
My last comments would just be that I think the legislative agenda that the Green Party of New York has put forward is really strong. And I think that it's so important that we have an independent voice outside of the two major parties that's able to continually push for these sorts of reforms and these sorts of measures without being beholden to the interests that they're beholden to, because we really represent the people of the state's interests, and that's a voice that needs to be heard.
And this has been Mark Dunley for WOOC.
How did you get involved with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine?
Well, I was very interested in radio a number of years ago. I had a show at another college radio station in the area with RPI. And
WRPI.
Yes. And I helped found this group called the Hudson Mohawk Independent Media Center. And so we worked on that for, you know, a number of years. And basically, I was an activist, and I'm always looking for ways to better spread the message about what activists are doing. And so given the corporate ownership of media, it was important to support both progressive but independent media. And then probably about 4 or 5 years, we ran the Hudson Mohawk Independent Media Center. And then Steve Pierce and Brandon Miller and others actually, through a friend of mine who's involved with the Green Party, Russ Ziemba, owned this church, and they were looking for space. And I said, oh, my friend has this church. He has no idea what to do with. He just grabbed the church.
That was the end of our segment with Mark Donnelly talking about green legislative.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Livonia Mallory. And up next, Dr. Guy?
Next up, we have on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory speaks with Dr. Dorothy Kim about the alt-right's efforts to co-opt medieval history.
Once again, we have another exciting segment of Reclaiming History.
Right here at 105.3 FM, the sanctuary for independent media.
I'm Livonia Mallory. Today we have a very special guest. Dorothy Kim teaches medieval literature at Brandeis University. Her research focuses on race, gender, the digital humanities, medieval women's literature, culture, medievalism, Jewish and Christian differences, books of history, digital media, and the alt-right. She was the 2013-14 fellow at the University of Michigan's Frankel Institute of Advanced Judaic Studies, where she drafted a monograph entitled Jewish-Christian Entanglements, Anchoring Wise and Its Material World, which is forthcoming from the University of Toronto Press. She also has two books, The Alt-Medieval Digital Whiteness and Medieval Studies, and Decolonize the Middle Ages, forthcoming from ARC Press. She is co-editing A Cultural History of Race in the Renaissance and Early Modern Age from 1350 to 1550 with Kimberly Coles, University of Maryland, College Park. Also is editing a special issue of Medieval Feminism Forum, a journal of gender and sexuality on medieval trans feminism. Dorothy Kim, welcome to another segment of Reclaiming History.
Thank you for having me, and I'm delighted to be on.
So there were Asian folks, African folks, going into Europe, trading with what we call Western Europe, Italy, Spain, France. These folks were crossing the waters and going back and forth into Europe. Was that really happening at that period?
Yes, because you have to think about the Silk Road from Asia. We also have evidence of archaeological digs where we have various kinds of material artifacts that are coming out of Asia that are being dug up in parts of Western Europe. We have this 12th century Islamic graves in France that were recently excavated that have been discussed as the first excavation of an Islamic community in Western Europe. If you think of it this way, before the Middle Ages, it is basically the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was wide and took up a lot of geography, and they liked to move people around. You know, they were these vast trade networks. For instance, the archaeological evidence out of Roman Britain that several of my classic colleagues have discussed make it really clear that London was a multiracial city in the Romano-British period. Why do we imagine that that changed all of a sudden when the Middle Ages happened? I think the thing to understand is that there was contact, there was lots of trade, but also people moving in and out. So my colleagues at York have a really lovely website about immigrants in the Middle Ages, and they have worked out the documents from a bunch of legal and other records, business records, and you can actually find where some of these immigrants are coming from. And they have immigrants in London coming from India in the 15th century. There's actually quite a number of Islamic immigrants. It's England's medieval immigrants, and it's sort of this database where you can actually look up where were these people moving from to England. So even somewhere as far western as England, where it was having this influx of various people and bodies from other parts of the world, the closer you are to the Mediterranean, the more straightforward that would have been. And I think people forget that Africa had, depending on which part of Africa, during what time period, there were clusters of really interesting civilization, what we think of as civilization, cultural centers. So you have Ethiopia, you have what's going on in Mali, you have Aksum in Eastern Africa. There's a bunch of stuff going on during the 500 to 1500 period. There's a new exhibit that is starting at Northwestern called Rivers of Gold that is also going to be shown in Toronto at one of the museums there. And then we'll eventually go to the National Museum of African American History in the Smithsonian. I think in the end of 2019, the beginning of 2020, that basically discusses the importance of Africa as a major trading and civilization location in the Middle Ages and how much wealth was actually being brought out of Africa into other parts of the world.
So you talk a lot about all of the research that's being done, and it sounds very exciting. How is the scholarly community receiving this, can I call it a more diverse view of history? How do your colleagues and other professors around the university system, this ivory tower, how do they receive this historical view of a very diverse medieval period?
I think it has been mixed. I think in one way, there is this willingness to think about these questions in relationship to widening the scope of the field, to think about a kind of global Middle Ages. But I also think there has been pushback in discussions related to methodology and what I would think of as decolonizing or anti-racist methodological and pedagogical practices in the field. So it's been mixed. There is definitely colleagues and people in the field who are ready to really push and break open this critical historical question, because I think at least a number of us realize that this is also a question about public history and public humanities and what is being sent out into the public universe about this medieval past, that it has a lot of political psych in relationship to it. But I think there's also some conflict about how that will be framed. Some colleagues are actually perfectly fine with a white supremacist medieval history. I mean, there are at least a handful of known white supremacist fascist medievalists that have identified themselves as such. So it's not as if we're all on the same page, if that makes sense, to kind of topple the ivory tower. I think it's a mixed thing. And I think the other thing is, it's interesting because some of that has become, for me, for the last couple of years, this sort of argument that gets pushed back on me about we can't discuss certain terminology or certain kinds of theoretical frames in the medieval past, which makes no sense to me because this is usually in relationship to, if I say we need to talk about these issues of race and the structures of race and how it was formed in the Middle Ages, I do get the pushback, particularly in medieval history circles, about, no, you can't talk about that because that's not actually historically accurate, because that wasn't a term that was used during the period. And it's interesting that they say these things to me, particularly when I bring up race, but they never say this to me when I say, oh, let's talk about medieval oncology, let's talk about engineering, or let's talk about the history of X and Y that doesn't have the kind of political attachments that the term race has.
So what you're saying is that when you talk about race within the medieval period, your colleagues are saying that race is a modern construct, and therefore it wasn't viewed the same way in that period, so we don't need to talk about it.
It's not just that they think it's anachronistic, it's also this idea that the pre-modern past is somehow pre-racial. They don't have to deal with these difficult issues related to race and racism and the transatlantic slave trade or the frame out of global empire and things like that. There's a couple of things going on there. They always push back by saying, oh, you should use the term ethnicity. We are not really addressing where we're getting this kind of terminology, and the pushback is really a pushback about the history of the field of history and social sciences and the history of the terms race, where in the late 19th, early 20th century North American historical studies, race was really imagined in biological ways. So it was a very eugenicist framing of the term race. And ethnicity was considered the better term to use because it meant that you could assimilate and become X or Y. This was where that terminology first got introduced into social science studies work. But then I think what my medieval historian colleagues have not addressed is that the 60s happens, the civil rights movement happens, and the call out from various politicized Black, Indigenous, people of color communities about the frames of assimilation and deciding that race is biological and eugenicist and not sociocultural factors as well as other things. And so the rest of the field of history dealt with the civil rights framing. The social sciences has moved to deal with what is now, 50 years of post-civil rights historical social science methodologies. Medieval historians have either willfully ignored or just have no clue that they're repeating the methodologies of a pre-civil rights and thus white supremacist historical social science methodology.
Dr. Kim, I can't believe it. We are out of time, but we've got to have you back on the show once again. To my listeners, make sure you tune in. Dr. Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Kim in another segment of Reclaiming History, talking about the alt-right's co-opting of the Middle Ages. And up next, Dr. Guy, we have another segment, a new one, Health Watch with Dr. Ooh. Sista. He's going to be talking about pulmonary embolisms. Dr. Sista is the section chief of vascular and interventional radiology at NYU Langone School of Medicine in Manhattan, New York. His clinical expertise lies in the medical and endovascular treatment of pulmonary embolisms. The sound you hear is the sound of a heartbeat. We're all just one beat away from life or death. Today I have a very special guest on the line with a new segment entitled Health Watch. Stay tuned.
Doctor, can you tell my listeners your full name and a little bit about yourself?
Lavonia, thank you so much for having me on your call. This is Akhilesh Sista. I go by Aki. I am a associate professor of interventional radiology at NYU School of Medicine. In my role, if you haven't ever heard of an interventional radiologist, we're basically the surgeons within the radiology field. So we basically do image-guided interventions to heal a situation that would otherwise require major surgery. So in my role as an interventional radiologist, I've participated on teams that take care of pulmonary embolism because some of my catheter-based skills and imaging-based surgeries are useful in the treatment of pulmonary embolism when the pulmonary embolism is severe. And as such, I've
gained a lot of, I've been very interested in the disease overall, and it has been the focus of my research and clinical practice. So I think that's sort of an introduction to who I am and why you're talking to me.
All right. Thank you so much. For my listeners, in full disclosure, I shared with the doctor that this year, May of this year, my younger brother passed away at age 52 of a PE, pulmonary embolism. He was actually on the tennis court playing tennis, African-American male, obese with a history of hypertension. He went to see his one of his doctors the morning before playing tennis, had an adjustment, I think it was a chiropractor, walked on the tennis court, hit the ball across the net a couple of times, and died, collapsed and died. So from that experience, I thought maybe there might be someone out there who can tell me a little bit about this condition and maybe save someone else from having to go through the traumatic experience that my family is still going through after the loss of my beloved younger brother. So doctor, tell me, what is a pulmonary embolism? Let's start there so my listeners can get caught up to speed. What is it exactly?
Well, first of all, let me give my heartfelt condolences to you and your family. It's a shocking and awful thing to go through. And unfortunately, this is a disease that can have that outcome. And I have seen firsthand how devastating this disease can be. And what's very difficult about it is that it can present so suddenly and without a chance of an intervention. And I do think that raising awareness is a good idea because if you have the symptoms of a pulmonary embolism, it's very important to immediately seek out medical care because there are many many patients who had symptoms for a while and then all of a sudden becomes worse or life-threatening. And that second part of it could potentially be avoided if you're aware of the symptoms, which we'll get to in a second. But to answer your question directly, a pulmonary embolism is basically a blood clot that travels usually from the legs through the venous system up towards the heart and lodges in the pulmonary artery after it passes through the right side of the heart. Now, the problem with this is that usually the blood flow through the pulmonary arteries is unimpeded. And so when you have this blockage there, blood flow is not great or not as good as it should be. Now, the size of the embolism is important. A big pulmonary embolism is usually more life-threatening. The reason is because there's just a lot of pressure that your right heart has to pump against, and it's not used to doing that. And in a big enough clot, the pressure in your ventricle can be so high that it can't overcome it and can't pump blood forward. And obviously, we all need blood going forward for us to live and for our tissues to get the nutrients and oxygen. And that's unfortunately what happened in your brother's case and probably many other patients who die from pulmonary embolism.
So it's a blood clot that travels from the leg to the right side of the heart. And when it gets there and there's a blockage and all this pressure builds up, the result is what happens to the heart, what happens to the lungs, what happens in that area, basically?
Yeah, good question. So after the clot passes through the right side of the heart, it exits into the pulmonary circulation. So it's no longer in the heart. It's actually in the blood vessel that emerges from the right heart. Now, once it's in that pulmonary circulation, then a couple things can happen. First of all, a person immediately feels shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, a little bit of chest pain, and the heart rate increases, so people can feel like they're having
episodes of palpitations in their chest. And what's happening is, so the threat is not so much to the lungs, actually. The lungs have a dual blood supply. They're also supplied by the systemic arterial circulation, which is happening in just right next to the right heart, is the left heart, and that's what pumps out all the blood to your body. The right heart pumps out all the blood to your lungs. So the lungs themselves are not that severely affected, although you can have a problem with gas exchange, and therefore your blood oxygen levels may decrease. But it's really the effect it has on the right side of the circulation. When the right heart isn't able to meet the demands of the pressure, it can't get blood over to the left heart. And once the left heart does not receive enough blood to pump forward, that is when your body is affected, because the blood can't get out from the left heart to your brain and your heart and all the other vital organs. And that's where the problems really get bad.
So you talked about some of the early symptoms. Shortness of breath is one. What are some of the other early symptoms that someone may be suffering from a PE?
Right. So the most common symptom is shortness of breath. So you just don't feel right, that, you know, all of a sudden or progressively over a couple days, you know, what you were able to do before takes more effort. So climbing a set of stairs in the subway or walking 5 city blocks. These are frequent stories I hear from patients. It's sometimes accompanied by chest pressure or heaviness on top of the chest, or frankly, chest pain. Less commonly, you can cough up a little bit of blood, and then also you can feel like your heart is racing. It's often mistaken, and not just by patients, but sometimes, unfortunately, by physicians, because these aren't necessarily specific symptoms for PE. They're mistaken for other conditions, say a viral illness, most commonly, and that's where it's a little bit dangerous. So basically, that's really where we're where the most danger lies, is either not paying attention to these symptoms or not recognizing that these symptoms are a PE.
So is it very easy for a physician to miss these early warning signs?
It is. Unfortunately, it is very easy to have that happen. Because these symptoms can be seen in many other conditions, and many of them are actually quite benign, like a viral illness, these things are much more common as well. You can't automatically assume that every person with shortness of breath has a PE. So that is where it's a little bit difficult to diagnose for physicians as well.
Dr. Sista, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with us today. For my listeners, tune in next time for part 2, when we will hear about some of the treatments that doctors are currently using to save lives for patients who are suffering from pulmonary embolisms. Dr. Sista, thank you.
It's my pleasure. And again, my condolences for your brother's loss. And I think that your advocacy will go a long way, hopefully, to preventing such occurrences as much as we can.
All right. All right. Thank you, Doc.
That was my segment, Health Watch, with Dr. Sista, talking about pulmonary embolisms.
Up next, to close out the show, we're going to be speaking with Jada Joof about her work with the organization Moms Rising. Jada, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you so much for coming on. Can you start off by talking a little bit about what Moms Rising does?
Yeah. So Moms Rising is an online movement, group of families, mothers, and women who cultivate and come together remotely to make social justice change. We do a lot of online petitioning. We do on-the-ground meetups. We go up to the Hill often to advocate to our legislators and leaders of the country for reform on policies that we're passionate about.
And then what do you do with Moms Rising?
So I am a campaign assistant at Moms Rising. I started about 2 years ago, fresh out of college. And I work on a series of campaigns. And what I do is I work on social media, so mm-hmm. getting the word out about the issues mm-hmm. that we're working on, and really just organizing and getting people to bringing people to Moms Rising mm-hmm. and having them get excited and getting involved and building up their passions to take issues on the actions that we advocate for.
Awesome. And so what kinds of issues are you working on right now?
So right now, as I mentioned earlier, I work on a few campaigns, some of them being maternal justice, the maternal justice campaign, Healthy Kids campaign, where we specifically focus on the school-to-prison pipeline, and an immigration team as well. And awesome. All those teams, we focus on a series of issues, of course, with all the things going on right now with immigration in the country. That is a hot team right now. So a lot of our actions are early, rapid response, and really just reacting to the things that we see online and policies that have been brought to our attention. And with the Healthy Kids team, we've recently sort of moved on from advocating for healthy school plans in schools and healthy marketing towards children in supermarkets and stores. And we really are trying to uplift the national crisis that students of color are being pushed out of schools and expelled out of schools and pushed into prisons. On the maternal justice team, we're focusing now on Black maternal health. Recently, Senate Bill 1112 passed, which changes the game for mothers who are expecting and mothers who have experiences, disparities in their medical and birthing experiences. So yeah.
Awesome. That sounds like really important work. Yeah.
All right. So, you know, I'm very excited about your work, the work that you're doing. Is there a way that someone can contact Mom Rising?
Yeah. So we are an online organization. So you can visit us at facebook.com/momsrising. That's MOMSRISING. On Twitter, same thing, at Moms Rising. Instagram, at Moms Rising. We also have a youth community, youth-based community that I coordinate alongside my other colleague, Beatrice. It's called Kids Rising.
All right. Well, thank you, Jada Ju, for coming on and talking to us about Moms Rising. Dr. Guy, that concludes our show. It's all over. Remember to tune in tomorrow and every weekday, 7 a.m., 9 a.m., 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get a dose of our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on Facebook's page. Also be sure to come in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative.
As a reminder, WOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks,
thanks for tuning in.